Morning Show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Once again, it is my pleasure and honor to be sitting opposite Dr. Art Sear from the faculty at Carthage College. Without a doubt, our most frequent morning show guest over the last couple of decades, and someone who always has interesting things to say about a wide array of topics and issues. And I'm sure today will be no different from any of his past visits. There are some very important things to talk about. Professor Sear, in addition to his work at Carthage, is also a columnist whose work appears in newspapers and journals all across the country, and also is author of the book After the Cold War. And we appreciate him making time in his busy schedule to be a welcome and treasured part of the morning show. Dr. Art Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Well, thank you, Greg. It's
always
nice to be here, and that's actually true in this case. I've mentioned to you off the air, you're very reminiscent of John Calloway. For many years, a singularly prominent, mostly television host on public TV in Chicago, and he was particularly proud of the fact after he interviewed Henry Kissinger, I think about Kissinger's very important book, Diplomacy, which was published in the 90s. He had the privilege of interviewing him and the former Secretary of State, among other things, and Kissinger complimented him afterwards. Dr. K does not hand out many compliments, in my limited experience, to others. He said, "Thank you so much. You actually read my book. I'm so pleased and I'm so grateful to you. You actually read my book. Media people do not read anything. And you always do your homework and have so many fine authors on the air. And our listeners are already aware of that, sort of, but it should be underscored."
Mm. I appreciate that. One of the things I like to say towards that end is I read the books if for no other reason, selfishly, to make it a more interesting interview for me, not just so it's interesting for the author or for the listeners, but selfishly as well. There's nothing more boring than bluffing your way through an interview where you really don't know anything. So anyway, but I appreciate the compliment very, very much. We have to begin with, of course, the shocking events that unfolded in Highland Park on the 4th of July, when, of course, as all of our listeners know, a mass shooting occurred, half a dozen people killed and more injured. Just a stunning turn of events, and yet in other ways not surprising. I mean, given this escalating epidemic of gun violence across the country. But I think it's fair to say that there was something exceptionally shocking about it unfolding in a place like Highland Park, which, of course, is close to our listening area. And I think, I'm not sure exactly where you live down in Illinois, but is that relatively close to where you
live? Yes, very close to my family home.
Yeah. So I just wondered what your reaction was to that and what you see in terms of a way ahead in trying to deal with this epidemic of gun violence?
Well, I don't have any. I'm certainly not going to give you the easy, glib answers that dominate the public discussion now. It is a continuing problem in this country, among industrialized countries. We don't have, compared to Europe, Japan, other countries that have gone through the Industrial Revolution, we don't have a feudal tradition. We are not, by definition, a stable society. We also have pervasive violence in the media since the 60s, readily available to very young children, very violent and graphic, video games of all kinds, readily available to anyone. We also have pervasive pornography, which is very, very destructive, especially for younger people, young women, as well as young men and boys and girls. I think that fact of life, which is never mentioned in major media in this country, is one factor among others. The first of these now unfortunately fairly common mass killings was in 1964. In modern times, a man, a very troubled man by the name of Charles Whitman, a Marine Corps veteran who served his country honorably and who'd been going through some very serious trouble. He consulted no less than five doctors and psychiatrists in the year leading up to his terrible violent behavior. He climbed up to the top of a very tall tower at the University of Texas, and he was a very good shot, a very good marksman. He killed 14 people and wounded, I believe, more than 30 others before two heroic policemen plus an armed civilian managed to get up to the top of the tower and kill him. President Lyndon Johnson did not rush to the scene. That would have been considered gross behavior by that generation at that time, but he did immediately propose gun control legislation, which was reinforced by the terrible assassination of Robert Kennedy in 1968. And by 1968, it was a struggle even for the very talented LBJ, legislatively one of the greatest legislative achievers in this country's history, as Senate Majority Leader as well as President. He did get significant legislation through, and that's all to the good. And we should all be happy about the fact that the Senate was able to get together rather quickly on gun control legislation. But the problem isn't guns. We Americans like to look to the other, something tangible, something technological, ideally, because that's what we love so much. If we can do this tangible thing, we'll solve the problem. But the real problem is us and our society, in my view. Obviously, I'm not running for office. And I'm fortunate not to be looking for work at the moment, but that's why you're not going to hear this that much. But that's what I honestly believe.
Right.
And I like to think that I would be saying that in any case.
Right.
I hope that's clear.
I think you're being very clear. And I think it points to something that we don't hear very much in discussions, that this tends to be the kind of conversation where either you think the problem is guns or the problem is not guns. And I think what you're pointing to is a wise middle ground, which is that the problem is not just guns. I mean, it is, the problem is not just easy access to guns, but the problem is also kind of a societal condition that is leading to more and more people that find themselves kind of in this emotional, agitated state of such anger or whatever it is that in which they lash out, and they're lashing out with weapons that can cause tremendous harm in a very short amount of time. But it's more than just one or the other, and there's not a simple solution, though we wish there was one. I think that's what you're saying, or am I shifting your focus?
No, not at all. There is a positive context, which is important to consider without in any way minimizing this latest tragedy or any others. Going back to Whitman in 1964, the long-term trend actually has been dramatic reduction in gun homicides as a proportion of the population in this country. We had an enormous, very violent crime wave crimes of all kinds, which became visible at the end of the 50s and continued into the early 90s. Then declined, there was a sudden rise, there was a peak in 1993. But in terms of available data, and it's reliable data today in America, there was a steep decline from 1993 that has continued. It started to reverse in 2014, and it's unclear, but we're nowhere near the levels of that earlier crime wave. There are lots of explanations, and politicians on the right, Barry Goldwater notably, Ronald Reagan, his successor in terms of policy and themes. Reagan benefited enormously, as we all know, by emphasizing this understandable fear and tremendous problem of violent crime. We don't have that today in the mass, but we do have our lives punctuated by these occasional horrible incidents which have become all too regular.
Right. It's interesting, too, you mentioned, for instance, incredibly graphic, violent games that are readily available and have an certainly have to have some kind of an influence on quite a wide swath of the population. And I think you're right that we talk about that remarkably little right now. I think once upon a time, there was more conversation about that. I mean, maybe when these games first began to emerge, there were shocked, troubled people who spoke up pretty forcefully about it. But I feel like we've grown accustomed to them. And so that is not talked about nearly as much as it should be.
Well, I'm glad you agree. Thank you. We don't always agree.
We do agree about that. So anyway, and I think we agree that we hope there'll be some path forward to finding not maybe a remedy, but a series of remedies that that can do something about this this terrible epidemic of events like this. Also, since your last visit to the morning show was the U.S. Supreme Court decision that effectively overturned Roe v. Wade, which, of course, has been in place for essentially half a century, if I'm not mistaken. I'm curious, first of all, if you were surprised by the Supreme Court's ruling regarding Roe v. Wade, and what you think that decision sort of portends in terms of what this court may be likely to do in the future with other issues.
Well, I personally was surprised, which means nothing at all. I have a very poor track record at predicting. I'm very good at discussing the past, like a lot of people who find themselves in academic positions. I've not been very good at predicting any kind of political event, and I should say that with emphasis. The court does tend to respect precedent, and John Roberts, in particular, the current Chief Justice, has been, I find, very impressive as someone who respects the law and abides by the law, but is able pragmatically to work out a consensus. He failed to do that in this case, and I hope that's not an indication that he's declining in influence as Chief Justice. I happen to believe he's been very effective. I'm fairly confident Ruth Bader Ginsburg is a Supreme Court justice who is admired by a large percentage, perhaps an overwhelming percentage, of the listeners of public radio. I very much agree with her point, which she made many years before she joined the Supreme Court, that a decision like the Roe versus Wade abortion decision should not be handled by the Supreme Court. It should be handled by the legislature, by the Congress. Understandably, the Congress preferred not to address that issue then or now. I'm very glad that President Biden has declared unequivocally that he's going to move forward with legislation to, in effect, protect the status quo established by Roe versus Wade, which has nothing to do with my own personal views on the subject, but everything to do with the fact that Justice Ginsburg was right. It should be in the legislature, and she made the point that every other Western nation that has addressed this very, very emotional, extraordinarily controversial matter has done so through their legislature. So that's good. We're going that route.
So I'd just be curious to know why you think this is a matter for the legislature versus the U.S. Supreme Court.
It's not a matter of law. The Supreme Court, out of the blue, in the early 1973, I believe, took the initiative on this matter as they did on others. It was a very different time from today when an activist Supreme Court in overall a liberal direction, which became very controversial and is the foundation of the current conservative reaction. It is a legislative matter. It had nothing to do, as the conservatives like to emphasize, with established law. And it was a state matter until a very aggressive Supreme Court intervened. It was a time when there was great concern about overpopulation. And Robert McNamara, who, speaking of LBJ Johnson, very graciously, given the personal circumstances of the Secretary of Defense at that time, made him president of the World Bank, where he had an extraordinarily long tenure, perhaps unprecedented. I believe 12 or 13 years. He was a very data-driven leader, obsessed with numbers, and concern about overpopulation was a dominant theme in the 50s and 60s. Malthusian, and population growth is going to overwhelm us. With 2020 hindsight, Jimmy Carter has trumped, so to speak, Bob McNamara. Carter is still spending his time as he approaches 100 years old. Jimmy Carter has been emphasizing economic development for the poorest nations in the world, as did McNamara, to the credit of both men. Carter makes the crucial point, education, not just sex education, any kind of education, literacy, teach people, more specifically women, to read, and the population will plummet. That, along with increasingly population growth, births will decline dramatically. That is the key to birth control. Also, the success of capitalism increasingly in the world, creating unprecedented prosperity to support all these people, has fortunately meant that the tremendous fears of that earlier time have abated. As usual, human beings have been able to overcome these problems. But that context, I think, is important to keep in mind.
In terms of what prompted the court in the first place,
the atmosphere, yes, the atmosphere of the time.
And just so I understand what you're saying, I think what you're saying, and I think what you're saying Ruth Bader Ginsburg is saying, is that in a sense, the court should never have taken up this matter in the first place.
Yeah.
In other words, Roe v. Wade itself was, in a sense, a mistake, that the court was venturing into a realm that where it did not belong, and that back then, as well as today, you're saying this is more a matter for the legislature to legislate law versus the court to issue a decree when it comes to this matter.
I don't think I said it was a mistake. I wouldn't say that about the Supreme Court, but it's a matter that should be, she said, and I agree, handled by the legislature. And I'm very glad that the Biden administration is moving in that direction.
So that is the appropriate wing of the government to take up an issue like that.
And it's not just my opinion.
Right.
I would urge people as well to stay away from the media, more or less. Not the morning show, of course. I mean, by all means, listen. But we also, as I said about a different, very ugly subject a couple minutes ago, we have pervasive media. And it's important to do your own homework, especially on basic moral questions, which is what this is for most Americans, whatever your position. Actually read the two latest Supreme Court decisions, I believe, that bear on this. Read Roe versus Wade. Read the two dissents, which I believe, I did not study up before appearing this morning, I confess, but I believe it was William Rehnquist, a kind of point person for the conservative wave in our legal system. Many will remember him as the presiding quote judge, unquote, in the impeachment of trial of Bill Clinton. And Whizzer White, W-H-I-T-E, the one Supreme Court justice that President Kennedy had the opportunity to nominate, Byron White, White and Rehnquist, read those two dissents. Do your own homework, especially because this has become such a central matter and so extraordinarily emotional,
right,
with extremely wild, including from the mayor of Chicago, who engages in really filthy gutter language in a public space, something that anyone with a responsible office should avoid doing. But given the tone and temper, it's really important for us Americans to do our own homework.
Right. That's a really good point, that for all that we bandy about the term Roe versus Wade, the vast majority of us, I count myself among them, have never read Roe v. Wade. I mean, what that decision exactly was in terms of words on the page, and certainly not taken the time to read the words of those who dissented 50 years ago. So that would be worthwhile for people to seek out. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Dr. Art Sear from Carthage College, our most frequent morning show guest over the last couple of decades, and I'm so glad that he can be here to take up some weighty issues and questions and concerns. We've already done so, of course, in our first bit here. I'm anxious to talk with you about a column that you wrote very recently about an extraordinary man from Hong Kong who goes by the name of Jimmy Lai. That's not his actual name, but that's how most of the world knows him. And I am embarrassed to admit how little I knew about Jimmy Lai, not much more than the name and just a little bit of, in terms of the headlines that have surrounded him. Your column was so provocative in the best sense of the word that it really sent me Googling to find out much, much more about him. What an amazing man. For the sake of anybody else listening who was as ignorant or is as ignorant as I was about Jimmy Lai, I wish you would just give a little sketch of his story and then what has thrust him into the headlines in such an unfortunate way over the last couple of years.
Well, more than a couple of years, he's a very successful business entrepreneur. Started, as you indicated, from poverty. He developed a very, very successful clothing business that I believe still exists. He sold it some years ago.
Right, Giordano.
Yeah, became enormously wealthy, which is high fashion clothing, not pizzas, not, although he may have been in that too. He's one of these endless entrepreneurs with endless energy and phenomenal business ability. He went on to found Apple News, not related to the cell phone and computer and technology company, and another news organization, both of which have stridently advocated for freedom for Hong Kong. And the Beijing government has persecuted him endlessly since then. What I didn't put in the column was a recent, both those news organizations were brutally shut down in traditional totalitarian fashion, the sort of behavior in which President Xi of China and, of course, President Putin of Russia excel. No less than 200 policemen showed up to arrest Jimmy Lai at home, put him in handcuffs and shackles, and literally drag him through the streets to his news offices, where the staff was not arrested, but the offices were essentially destroyed. The police took away files, cabinets, and all of which appeared, unlike the Nazi Party in the 30s and 40s, unlike the Soviets from the 1920s until the end of the Cold War in about 1990. All of this was on Facebook Live. The mostly young staff in Jimmy Lai's offices put everything on video. And given the nature of the world today, President Xi and associates would love to have gunned down all those people or sent them to the gulag or otherwise ended their lives, but they couldn't do that. What they have done is locked up Jimmy Lai. They do have a kind of semi-fraudulent bogus due process in Hong Kong, but they cannot just arbitrarily lock people up. The genesis of this column was July 1st, which is the anniversary, the 25th anniversary of the 1997 turnover by the government of Great Britain to the government of China of the Crown Colony of Hong Kong. The British negotiated a treaty of 100 years with what was a sort of government of China back in the 1800s, and they abided by the treaty. Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and associates negotiated a departure. They did put legal guarantees in place, which Beijing, for the rights of Hong Kong citizens, which Beijing honored for a couple of years, but they've become increasingly brutal in cracking down. And Mr. Lai personifies this crackdown. He's now in prison. I hope he lives long enough to be released. Again, for the reasons I've tried to make clear, the Chinese would love to kill him, but it's not like the good old days, as Putin from time to time has alluded to. We just can't operate the way we used to. He has said in prison that this is this very wealthy, successful businessman. This is the most rewarding time in my life because I feel I'm doing something of special value and special worth.
Right.
So he's the right kind of business person. It's not just about money, our life.
Right. Yes. And so, in effect, I think the reason he sold off his interest in Giordano was in order to create these newspapers or other media outlets that were pro-democracy and to speak out very, very forcefully as his concerns and the concerns of others began to escalate. Can you just remind us, why did Britain choose to, in a sense, relinquish Hong Kong back in 1997? What would have been the reason for them to want to do that, given Hong Kong's incredible value?
Well, they were abiding by the law, which I'm not defending colonialism or imperialism or any other bad things, even though some listeners might think I am. Their legal agreement, the treaty, it was a literal treaty. The treaty came to an end.
And they had little choice then. I mean,
well, they could have forced the issue, but they didn't want to go to war with China. And actually, China had the law on their side.
I see.
And the British, not everyone will agree with me, and not just our Irish friends will disagree, but the British overall have tended to abide by the rule of law. Also, it would have been a fool's game to try to hold on to Hong Kong with the enormous military as well as economic power of China nearby and tremendous incentives to do something to try to at least embarrass the British government.
Right. So as you very rightly...
No, I hope that point is clear. It was a legal agreement, and the time came to an end. China absolutely refused to renegotiate it, and it wasn't worth an incident. And the British are far more pragmatic than we are, in my biased opinion, in foreign policy. We can learn a lot from them. Something I became very convinced of during the Vietnam War when I was quite young. They decided to handle it pragmatically, but put legal guarantees in place. And that provides us with leverage in the law, as well as common decency and other good things, but in the law to counter China as we have done. The Trump administration ended most favored nation status for Hong Kong, which has had some short-term economic downsides for financial services companies, banks, investors, others. But it was the right thing to do, and it benefits us by giving us the high ground, not just in moral terms. And the Biden administration, for all the president's efforts to distance himself from Trump, the Biden administration automatically continued the sanctions that the Trump administration put on China as a result of the atrocious treatment of the people of Hong Kong. There have been mass demonstrations. Mr. Lai personifies a very large-scale movement that has been suppressed but continues to exist.
Right.
For liberty in Hong Kong.
And you speak out so forcefully in this column. I mean, you talk about how China has been, in your words, ruthlessly obliterating political freedom there. Brutal, bloody, continuing repression. I mean, you're not holding back your punches as you describe the situation there. And what I think you're saying is China is in violation of this, in a sense, agreement with Britain.
Yeah.
And that gives us the moral ground. And your column ends by calling for the United States and other nations to do whatever they can. And in the midst of saying that, you say China has been deterred before. So in other words, we shouldn't shrink away from this fight. It is possible to move the needle, even when we're talking about an adversary like China.
The column begins with one of my favorite quotes from my favorite founder, Ben Franklin. Gentlemen, we must all hang together, or most assuredly, we shall all hang separately, meaning confronting the enormous power of Great Britain at that time. We've got to be unified and work out our differences. Something to keep in mind in the very warped, from my point of view, rather ahistorical discussion that is quite public about the sin of slavery and how to address it.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll be watching the situation carefully. And, of course, I appreciate, again, having this amazing, inspirational figure of Jimmy Lai,
yes,
kind of brought
yes.
brought to the forefront in this recent column, really quite extraordinary.
And thanks to this kind of international pressure, over the short term, China's in charge in Hong Kong, but the movement of events and sentiments in the world is very much our way. I'm old enough to remember the Cold War rather vividly in some ways, and we were on the defensive. In many ways, the Soviet Union was particularly successful just before it wasn't, in the 70s in particular, and into the 80s. We were on the defensive against communism, and during the 50s and through the 60s, if contemporary liberals especially question a lot of the aspects of American foreign policy back then, from the great heights, especially of academia and the media, the United States was very literally on the defensive. Hmm. And the situation is reversed today. Things are moving our way. It's China, the Soviet Union, North Korea that are on the defensive.
Right, holding on to an old way of doing
exactly.
things.
That is crumbling.
Right, and freedom is on the rise. I mean, at least generally speaking, that is where the world is tilting.
Undeniably. Mm-hmm. The new nations, which emerged in great numbers in the 1960s, they tended to identify with the Soviet Union, and the Soviet Union and China, separately after their rift at the end of the 50s, were enormously aggressive with great success in cultivating nations of what was called the Third World at that time. The situation has gone completely now.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about two other columns you've recently written. I mean, I think one might be the one that is about to be published a little later this week that also concerned the Far East. One of them talking about the escalating belligerence from North Korea in terms of the missiles that they have been launching. And apparently they took a day early in June and launched a plethora of missiles in a single day. And South Korea, and in cooperation with us, did the very same thing the very next day in a very strong response to that. But it's as you're talking about this, what could be an alarming show of belligerency from North Korea, you call for us to remember three kind of central points when it comes to dealing with North Korea, a country you know a whole lot about. Even though they are so, in some ways, shut away from the West. So remind us about the things we need to remember about North Korea, beginning with just the inescapable fact that it is erratic. I guess we have to accept that about this particular foe.
They're erratic within very significant limits. They have been fitfully developing missile technology such that they now have... These were not long-range missiles that were launched on a single day. It was the first time they've launched eight. And we and our very close South Korean allies immediately responded tit for tat by launching. Symbolism's important in diplomacy and strategy. The Obama administration, to their credit, as North Korea began to develop long-range missiles, these eight were not. But they now have an intercontinental ballistic missile, sort of, that could reach the United States. As it became clear they were developing these longer-range capabilities, the Obama administration, very much to President Obama and associates credit immediately moved anti-missile defense systems to Guam, Hawaii, to the West Coast. This is very iffy if anti-missile technology will work in war. It's guaranteed to work to a degree. But the symbolism involved was extremely important, and it's better to have some defense than no defense. The most important point to keep in mind is, for all the bluster and occasional terrible violence, the armistice is held since 1953. Dwight Eisenhower, a very great president, not just in my opinion, especially in hindsight, when all things become clear, was capable of great brutality, very much masked by the genial, rather grandfatherly image of golfing and emphasis on positive thinking that he developed in the White House. But there were very good reasons. We were literally in a fight for our lives in World War II, and there were very good reasons why General Marshall and President Roosevelt jumped him over, I think, about 100 more senior star officers to lead the crucial initial invasion of North Africa and go on from there. By 1953, when Eisenhower was inaugurated, there was a long-term, very unpopular stalemate going on in Korea. And it seemed to be endless. It was a reason why President Truman was as low as Richard Nixon in the polls when he declined to run for re-election, as he had planned years in advance. Whatever the situation, Truman decided that almost two terms was long enough, very much to his credit, and left the stalemate for Eisenhower. It was a major issue in the Republican campaign in 52. It was something that Eisenhower emphasized rather obliquely but effectively, saying, "I will go to Korea and nothing beyond that." The history is extremely interesting. Eisenhower did go to Korea, and there were great photo ops and great PR, and his genial smile was in evidence in the middle of winter. He decided very quickly that the war had to be folded. He writes in his memoirs, which are challenging and voluminous, and I planned it that way. You got to be serious to get through this stuff, but it's well worth your time. He decided very quickly that the defensive positions were so strong that it would take a major new offensive to change the status quo, and the American people weren't going to accept that. And he didn't think it was worth it strategically. There were very few military targets left in North Korea. The Eisenhower administration used the good offices of India. John Foster Dulles, the very hawkish Secretary of State, indicated very specifically that we would use nuclear. We were considering using nuclear weapons. We wouldn't have done that, but that was useful at the time. Joseph Stalin, who had initiated the longtime tyrannical leader of the Soviet Union, was good enough to die in early 53, which added more flexibility. That's in the public record. What isn't in the public record is that we started bombing everything. We started killing everyone north of the 38th parallel. We bombed dams, which is a war crime. Vast, I mean like hundreds of square miles of North Korea were underwater, and nothing visible except dead carcasses and, you know, various wreckage floating on the surface. The power grid, such as it was in northeastern China, went dark for a long period of time because we obliterated any kind of power supply in North Korea. This isn't in Ike's memoirs. You got to look to find this in the public record. I believe there's only circumstantial evidence for this, but in the endless truce talks at Panmunjom, which had been going nowhere, Eisenhower was very, you cannot find a paper trail going up to the president of any of these orders or anything that was done. I'm convinced that the American officers, when the ever-present cameras were off, the microphones were off, told their North Korean and Chinese counterparts, "We're going to keep this up forever. We have endless B-29s. We're going to bomb you 24/7 until everybody's dead, or they wish they were. So why don't you sign on the armistice line? Don't you think that would make sense?" And they did. And the armistice has held. Crazy Kim, the current leader of North Korea, in 2013, I think, declared a state of war and tore up the armistice agreement and had one of his tantrums. But the armistice has held. And it's important to keep that in mind, because nobody discusses it in our country. I can assure you, North Koreans, not just the fearful feudal elite at the top, but people generally in North Korea are well aware of the horror of what the Americans imposed in 1953. And it's very important to keep that in mind when you get frustrated with what seems like maybe a cautious American approach to North Korea.
Right.
I hope that's clear. It's very important. And it's one of the facts of life that's extremely important for us Americans. But we don't talk about it at all, even in serious discussion.
Right. And you finish the column by saying it's also important to remember that whatever we do in response to North Korea, that we not do it in isolation.
No, the South
Korea. We do it in cooperation with other nations, including, of course, South Korea, but not just South Korea.
Yes. I believe Richard Nixon is a very great president in policy terms, a remarkably schizophrenic man, and a very almost Shakespearean, self-destructive figure for someone who gets to the top in politics. But he and Henry Kissinger brought a disciplined approach, I believe, to diplomacy and strategy that was lacking in the frazzled last months of the Johnson administration, especially. And I believe that the way they handled the Vietnam War in those terrible circumstances was a right approach. I'm very mindful that an awful lot of people don't agree with that point of view. But they started reflecting their discipline, a very detailed annual statement on American foreign policy and the world, rather pompously called the State of the World. They're well worth reviewing, and the very first one, right after Nixon became president, emphasized we can't do everything. Our resources are limited. Also, other countries can do more. Mm-hmm. And I think that applies directly to South Korea. It may seem like common sense today, but it was a novel notion at the height of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. I recall reading it at the time and being very impressed.
I want to also
and South Korea is one. Sorry, I have a really strong positive affinity for South Korea, and it's one of the remarkable success stories of human history. One of the poorest countries in the world into the 1960s, one of the top 10 or 12 economies in the world, and a functioning democracy. Kind of wild and crazy, but still a very functioning effective democracy with alternation in power and the rule of law.
Yeah. An incredible story. It really is.
Another really tragic figure, President Park, the first woman president of South Korea, someone who was not up to the job, is serving time in prison now for corruption. I wish they'd let her out myself, but they do enforce the law in a rather heavy-handed way. But it's a far cry from the total and rather frightening dictatorship that the imprisoned President Park's father, Park Chung-hee, longtime heavy-handed, very brutal dictator of South Korea, that was only a few decades ago.
Hmm. The turnaround is extraordinary. It really is.
It is, yeah. And Americans should be very proud of this. Yeah. I'm very glad we don't obsess about the Vietnam War the way we used to. I'm very sorry that we don't spend more time collectively thinking about and addressing our tremendous success stories in the world and South Korea. It's the South Koreans' accomplishments, but we've played a vital protectors and underwriters role.
You brought up Vietnam, and so I'm going to shift gears, and we just have about 3 minutes left, but in your column that's upcoming, I believe, you talk about the nation of Indonesia.
Yes.
And what an important player they are in that part of the world. And the column actually ends in kind of intriguing fashion when you say, Vietnam veterans should feel pride in this long-term success. That is, in terms of the positive relationship we have forged with Indonesia, a nation of great strategic significance, which has had, you tell us, representative government since 1998. Just explain that last intriguing statement about how Vietnam veterans, who of course probably in a lot of ways feel some frustration about what was not accomplished in Vietnam, despite all of their sacrifices, but how, in terms of this success story with Indonesia, that they can take pride in that.
Indonesia's another functioning democracy. Corruption is a very, very big problem. But they do have elections. The largest one-day election in the world's history, a free and open election, was held in 2019. India has elections, but I think they vote over a period of time. It's the largest Muslim-majority country by far in the world. I believe India's Muslim population is literally larger, but that's a minority in a Hindu majority. They are a tremendous source of natural resources and raw materials, and they're another country that has moved our way. The reverse situation was the case in the 1960s. The Soviet Union was enjoying enormous success at integrating, eventually dominating Indonesia. There were increasingly close military exercises. The Soviets and the Indonesians were mixing their naval crews. They were integrating their military forces to a very significant and disturbing degree. A major reason for the enormous American military escalation in Vietnam in the air in February of 65 over the north, and then on the ground in the south in the summer of 65, was the reality that the South Vietnam House of Cards regime was collapsing. But another factor was the fact that Indonesia had moved into the Soviet Union. I know for a fact that President Johnson and Secretary McNamara and others who were reluctantly making this decision to intervene, McGeorge Bundy and Dean Rusk and all the usual suspects from that time, that was very much on their minds. It's never mentioned today in popular discussion, and I don't see it mentioned much in more serious literature on the policy decisions of that time. So it helps us understand the situation, and from my point of view, it makes more understandable the American intervention in South Vietnam. I also know for a fact that leaders throughout Southeast Asia told U.S. officials privately, no one would talk publicly. They also told Richard Nixon in his endless Marco Polo trips around the globe before he came back politically in 68, that your presence in Vietnam is essential for regional stability. Don't quote me, but that is the reality, and that's a point that I was getting at.
Interesting.
I hope that's clear. It's important.
And so that laid the groundwork, in a sense, for this much more positive relationship, for instance, that we now have with Indonesia, which is a really important nation on the world stage.
Yes, I think it creates some understanding and, to me, sympathy for a figure who's quite unsympathetic, Lyndon Johnson. And it also underscores the tremendous credit we should be giving to Nixon and associates, Kissinger, and also a non-public figure, a very fine man named Winston Lord, for opening the door to China. The U.S. suffered a strategic defeat ultimately in Vietnam, but Nixon countered that brilliantly, very hard to do at the time, by opening the door to China and greatly mitigating and minimizing any kind of larger victory for the communist powers.
Interesting.
It was a revolution that was limited to Vietnam and the Vietnamese revolutionaries. I hope that's clear. It's not easy stuff, I think, to grasp, and I get paid a salary to spend part of my time trying to understand this stuff.
Right.
But if it's not clear, feel free to get in touch with me.
Right. I think you've told that complicated story well. I wish we had time to get to the last topic, which is the increasing presence of corporate America in space exploration, but we're going to save that for when you come back in August.
Oh, good.
For our next conversation, which I look forward to very, very much.
Reason to come back.
Right. But in the meantime, I appreciate all that we were able to discuss today. It was illuminating as always. Dr. Art Sear, a colleague of mine from the faculty of Carthage College, great to have you here as always on The Morning Show.
Well, thank you. The feeling is mutual. It's a great tonic for me.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, We talk about flowers in the upcoming Four Seasons Garden Club's Secret Garden Walk on Friday. Ray Scott, former NBA player and coach, the author of a very interesting new memoir called The NBA in Black and White. You'll hear the interview that I recorded with him on Friday.